All right, now I'd like to introduce Paul Jarski, who's going to talk to you about building the transparent supply chain. Paul from Deere. Take care, brother.
Thanks, Glenn. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to talk about a company that maybe most of you have heard of, John Deere, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a history lesson to start with. Talk about technology and innovation as it relates to ag and construction and where our company has come from and where we're going in the future and how obsolescence management and really life cycle management is so critical to Deere and our customers. So we know that Deere is a large company in this segment, but where did it come from? Well, it started with a blacksmith, an East Coast blacksmith that immigrated, I call it immigration, to the Midwest, to Illinois, and he saw a need. The farmers of the time constantly had to stop their horse-drawn plows and pull off the dirt because it was a heavy, thick soil that stuck to the plow. They had to be stopping constantly. So what Mr. Deere did is he developed a self-scouring steel plow, built it out of an old saw blade, and it actually was such a shiny surface that nothing stuck to it. That was the innovation, the technology that had never existed before that Deere brought to the growing movement west for this country, for the U.S. And as the next 80 years went along, we were an implement company, and more accurately, a horse-drawn implement company. Plows, diggers, cultivators, grain carts, grain seeders, those types of things. In the early 20th century, though, something came along called the internal combustion engine. And the company recognized that this internal combustion engine thing might be important. What's really interesting is when you look at some of the archival advertisements in Deere's archives and others, you see the ads say that this will never replace the horse, but it's a good supplement to the horse. So 101 years ago, we got into the vehicle area. And again, for the next several decades, we were an implement and vehicle company. Fast forward a few decades, and the technological revolution, the electrification of the world occurs. To the point where, in 2019, Deere had a booth with a full-blown combine harvester at the Consumer Electronics Show. Why are we at CES? The reason we were and we will be is to demonstrate that these are no longer just big iron equipment. This is a rolling data center. This is a supercomputer on wheels. It's a supercomputer on wheels doing a very, very technically complex job. And it's doing it automatedly. That's not even a word. But you know what I mean. It is doing all of the adjustments for the combine as it's going through the field. I joke only partially with my family that still farm. When I hear from them the most is in the time when they're seeding and when they're harvesting. Because they're sitting on their phones texting me at work while the vehicle drives itself down the field. And why is that important? Well, there is no more arable land, and nobody's figured out how we can create more. And until we can travel to other planets and create more arable land, we only have so much. The population is growing, and all of those people, oddly enough, want to be clothed, they want to be fed, they want to have some sort of reasonable lifestyle. So how are we going to feed all of that population? The way is technology. Technology that can do this. Plant a field in three different directions with no skips, no overseeding, and then harvest that in the least amount of time. That's what technology brings to us in our industry, and it is an incredible advantage for our population as a whole to be able to do this so that we can feed, clothe, and shelter this growing population on Earth. With that being said, it does offer an interesting opportunity. We have new developments that we need to be making constantly. We need to be putting this out there to continue to advance this science and technology world for crops and for construction areas. However, one of the things that Deere has built their business on is our long-term service support for our customer base. The pictures that you see on the middle right-hand side of the screen are some pieces of equipment that have been around for a long time. The middle picture, that middle tractor that you see there, is the most produced tractor in John Deere's history. It's the iconic 4020 tractor. It was introduced in 1965. I can tell you right now that there are many farms across the country and across the world that 4020s are still in use every day. What's more, our customers expect that they can walk into a dealership and buy parts for that vehicle or the vehicles that were prior to that vehicle and get their equipment back up and running. So our life cycles are considered in decades. One of my favorite comments that I had, emails that I had just recently, was an email last week that said, Paul, or said to a group of us, how are we going to make sure that our 2005 era vehicles are able to be supported in 2100? Think about that. The 4020 that you see in 1965 was all mechanical. The vehicles in 2005 and in 2019 aren't all mechanical. So now you recognize why this type of a conference is so important to John Deere. So how do we go about doing this? Well, I work in the electronics division, and Deere does have its own electronics manufacturing facility. We have our own surface mount lines. We certainly don't build all our own electronics, nor will we, but we build a lot of them. So as part of that, we have a component engineering group, and we have a design engineering group. And one of the things that is important, is critical, and when I took over component engineering and really launched centralized component engineering about 8 years ago, was the fact that of our data integrity. We have a product lifecycle management tool system. It's a commercially available system. We have highly customized it, but all of our data is in there. Our bills of material, our approved manufacturer list, our quality analysis, all of that information is there. Our BOMs are built in there. It's awesome. However, in 2012, when I got that group, I got constant emails, PLM junk. Well, that's a good heading to see. When I looked at that, I went, okay, what do they mean? Well, we had had that system for a decade already. Nobody was in charge of maintaining that data. So everybody was putting it in, and when they put it in, it was good. But a decade later, it wasn't any good. So we launched onto an initiative to clean up and maintain the database. First, we said, okay, component engineering owns the database. Anybody have any objections? And the room stepped back. So that was great. The next thing was, how do we clean it up? And unfortunately, folks, I can only tell you it's roll up your sleeves and do it. There's nothing glamorous about it. You just get it done. What we did find, though, is as we did that, that made that validity of that data and the trust that we had with our design colleagues and our procurement colleagues increased every year. This summer, Silicon Expert approached me, and we're doing a lot of good work with them. It's really interesting, and they said, hey, can we take a look at your database? Sure. Send it to them. They came back and said, well, Paul, we'd like to sell you a service about cleaning up your database, but here's the data. You're already as clean as we've ever seen, so we're not going to sell you that service. Well, thanks. That's great to get that outside understanding of what our database was. That is a critical first step. It takes a lot of work with our suppliers and with our customers, internal and external, but to get that. The next thing we can do then, once we have data that we are comfortable with and information that we're comfortable with, is we can work with some of these outside parties as well as our OCM suppliers to really understand the life cycle risk. I talked about how long our life cycles are. So we developed a process where we use third-party data feeds. Yes, we use IHS. Yes, we use Silicon Expert. And we feed those right into the system, that integrated system, by part number, by manufacturer part number. And then we set that We use that estimated years to end of life feed that's in both systems, and we set a threshold. Because of our long life cycle, we say anything going to be around 8 years and longer, we're going to call that low risk. That's what we want to be using. Medium risk, 6 to 8 years. High risk, less than six. That seems like a long time. I know we're talking a memory device. That means everything's high risk. Yes, it is. But that's okay because we know that we have to plan for that then. But having that isn't enough. What do we also need? We needed to implement some sort of evaluation of that data set. I'm not a very trusting person, unfortunately, maybe fortunately. So we went out to the manufacturers and said, here's the data we have. Tell us if it's right or not. And when we did that, they came back and said, hey, you know, don't change anything. 98% of the data that we had from those third-party service providers, they said, yep, that's accurate. Great, we have some comfort level with our data. So that was a really, really important part of supply chain transparency. The next area that we wanted to use this data for is recognizing that just having the data isn't enough. How do you systematize this process so that your design colleagues aren't using a part? They don't want to have to go through all of this, so you build it into the system, and that's exactly what we did. For a low-risk part, they can put it onto a bill of materials. They're off and running. Great. For a medium-risk part, they have to get a supply-based manager's approval with a business case for why they're using that. And for a high-risk part, they need that supply-based manager, and more importantly, they need their boss's boss, the engineering manager's approval to use that part. Design engineers are no different than anybody else. They're going to take the path of least resistance. I don't want to use a high-risk part because then I have to talk to someone. And that has been really, really effective to reduce the number of times that we have unplanned obsolescence in our development phases. But how good is this data? How useful is this data? Do we have our thresholds set correctly? So towards that end, we decided, you know what, let's look at our end of lives. How many are we getting? And we get them just like everybody else, and let's normalize that against that part level and see where they're falling out. Do we have our threshold set correctly? And what you'll see on this graph is, and the colors are John Deere colors, so they're a little bit hard to see, but in 2018, for an example, over 98% of our end of lives came from that high-risk category. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us our thresholds are pretty darn good. More importantly, it tells us if we're using a high-risk part, let's get the hell out of it. And it also says, if we get one of those unplanned obsolescence, what should we do about it? So what we implemented is a corrective action process about 3 years ago, where we go back to the supplier, and we use our corrective action system because I didn't know where else to put the data, and said, why did this go end of life? I get it. Every company out there that we're going to be doing business with is not in it for altruistic reasons. They're all for-profit companies. So if there's no market there, they're going to get rid of it. Okay, I can get that. But if you're doing end of lives and not telling me when I expect that you should be telling me or giving me some heads up, and you do it over and over and over again, then my eyebrow raises, my neck turns red, and God forbid my ears turn red, because then you're in trouble. So we shared that with our supply base, and they went, oh, okay, we need to make sure that we get that information to you. And what we have seen is a greater and greater amount of our end of lives actually coming from that high-risk category, exactly what we'd expect to see. Finally, what we also wanted to do is, now that we have this rolling, how do we take that data and take it to the next level? Because end of lives, we all know, are going to happen. It's going to happen. How do we start building in a more proactive refresh process? We have a good development process. We know the data's coming. But how do we start doing this in a more proactive manner? Because if you look at it from a part-by-part instance, it's always going to be cheaper to just buy a bunch of parts. But if we look at it holistically across the life of that product or program or platform or enterprise, then it makes sense to, how do we start reinvesting more intelligently in this area? The last area that I wanted to cover is supply chain transparency is a topic near and dear to my heart because I had to live it when we launched into the chemical compliance world. I don't think any of you would, well, please raise your hands if you think chemical compliance is fun to work on. Yeah, that's what I thought. It's a burden. It felt like a burden. There's a lot of different regulations. And when we started this, we certainly went down the, let's just collect a certificate of compliance and move on with our lives. And then we recognized as more and more of these were going to hit us, how do we do this more intelligently? Well, let's make the effort and collect full material disclosures using the IPC 1752A form and put it right into the system. That was a lot of work. That is a lot of work. We continue that work. But how can you leverage it? We all know about the trade war. Earlier this summer, my people several layers above me came and said, you know, we hear about these rare earth elements that are used in a lot of things. Where are they in our supply chain? We went into our system. I pulled down the 13 rare earth elements, sent them over to my component engineers and compliance team and said, tell me what parts we have in it. In less than 2 days, we had that data. We now know what we have, and if there's anything that's going to happen in further, at least we're prepared to not just say that collective company-wide, oh shit, pardon my French, we can actually be ready for something if we see those storm clouds on the horizon. So in summary, really, communication is more important than ever. You know, you'll hear me spout off at virtually every one of these events, I need the component manufacturers talking to the third-party service providers. Why? Because while I love talking to the component manufacturers themselves, I have a system where aggregating that data and feeding it in with one or two APIs is way easier than feeding it in from 50. So please have a communication. Communicating with the contract manufacturers that you use. Make sure that your system and theirs are talking to one another, that your people, for the love of God, your people are talking to one another. Talking to your customers, to your OEMs is critically important. And then talking in this community. One of the things that I mentioned to Rob yesterday was when I started coming to FOM, and I've been to all three North America events, the reason I came here was I was terrified that we were so far behind that we'd never catch up. Well, I got here, and I'm not saying that we're ahead by any stretch of the imagination, but what I did see is, I guess we're not as far behind as I thought. Everybody has those same challenges. What's even more interesting, when I go back and I tell my leadership across the enterprise, a dear enterprise about this, they kind of look at me, and it's like a family. You never listen to your brothers and sisters. I get that. But when I say Lockheed Martin and BAE and Northrop Grumman say it, they're like, oh, well, then it's a problem. Well, thanks. Great. Fine. Don't listen to me. Listen to them. I'm good with that. So data integrity is critical, and there's really more opportunities emerging every day on how we can take that data and turn it into actionable information. With that, I'll open it up for questions.
Give it up for Paul. Here we go.
Thank you, sir. Nice work. So our first question will be, what are the best metrics? Oh, this is from Willie Brown, so it's going to be a tough one. What are the best metrics for? One, showing the effectiveness of one's obsolescence management program, and two, securing the funding for the obsolescence management program, Willie Brown BAE Systems.
Well, that's a great question. I heard somebody mention it this morning. It's hard to measure a negative. And it really is, when we looked at end of lives, and when we started this, we said, how are we going to measure that we didn't have a crisis? Well, when we started it, it was fortunate enough that we had had enough development programs that had had an unplanned obsolescence in the middle of the development phase that the wounds were still, they weren't even scabbed over. They were still bleeding. So we said, if we can start reducing those numbers by doing that process of driving that rigor up front, if we can do that, people will recognize how important that is. The other thing is then taking what I showed on that, looking at where our EOLs are coming from, people are going, oh, well, no kidding. If they're high risk, that's where we'd expect it. Those are a couple of the important metrics. The other part is making sure that we work with our design colleagues and our platform colleagues to recognize that this is a pull, that they're looking for this data. One of my favorite examples of a spectacular failure is I took all of these this data, and I had my component engineers run every bill of materials and pull every high-risk and medium-risk part for every assembly that we produce, several 12, 1,300 assemblies, and give it to every platform program manager and say, here it is. Here's your high-risk and medium-risk parts. Here's how many years that they've got left. I thought it was elegant. It was great. They'd be all excited about it. Like I said, it was a spectacular failure. You know how many people use that? Zero. So now, as we're seeing more and more of this and raising that awareness, people are saying, well, we should be using this. And I'm like, yeah, that's a good idea. Wish I would have had it 3 years ago. It's okay. Willie, does that answer your question?
All right. How does John Deere plan to deal with obsolescence in the face of growing proliferation of electronics in their vehicles and the long life cycles that their products are expected to deliver from Ethan at GDCA? And he had most of that answered in your presentation, but go ahead and dig into it.
Well, it's a real, we haven't figured it out. Don't, by no means think that we've got it this all solved. What we have recognized is that we have to take this from a part by part. Like I said, if you think of it by a part by part, it'll always be easier just to buy a bunch of parts. If you start looking at it platform by platform, aggregating that product, then you start saying, you know what, maybe it is okay to have a refresh here, a redesign here. Maybe we can consolidate some of this. Some of the discussions about ASICs and FPGAs this morning was really interesting to me. How do we do this a little bit differently? They're not going to just come with giant more buckets of R&D money. I get that. So how do we do this more effectively? We certainly haven't figured it out, but that's really where we're starting to move towards is how do we look at this instead of siloed as a holistic multi-million billion dollar corporation and really tackle it in that way?
All right, very good. Did we answer that question for you, Ethan? If you're here, okay. All right, now we'll go to the floor. You've just had a nice education in how to run a, we're going to go right over here to the right, how to run a OM program from a digital perspective, analytical perspective. Go ahead.
Okay, this is Andrew Schwab from Applied Materials. As far as suppliers go who are giving you late notifications on obsolescence, how have you successfully, as a company, got them to provide you the obsolescence details in as far as a long-term notification, so a year, 2 years, 5 years out?
So I would say that what we make sure that everybody recognizes how important these long life cycles are for us, and I'd say for our A-item bomb piece parts, that we have very strategic relationships with those, the Infineons, STs, Arrows, NXPs, blah, 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 blah. Well, not Arrow. Well, yes, Arrow, but they're not a component manufacturer. So we're getting that kind of roadmaps. What was really the next level was important is to get with the discretes and some of the, I'll call them B items on the bombs and say, you know, this is really important to us that we know about what's going on in the discrete market and share with us what's going on in the technology realm, the package size, and make sure that we have an idea that this is going someplace that we aren't there yet. And that's really been beneficial, and something that we're working on right now is actually having another field where it's new technology. It's not for new design, that's true. A part may be still active, but if a manufacturer says, you know, we're moving to a smaller package in this, I want to make sure our design engineers know that we can still use it in existing, but let's start transitioning over and get that new part, new package style qualified and going now rather than wait until the crisis hits. Does that answer your question?
Outstanding. I think someone has the mic over here.
So I just had a question. Does your data set include like mean time to failure for your components?
Sorry, I couldn't hear that one.
Does your data set include mean time to failure, and how does that affect your product support?
We do have mean time to failure on some parts. Reliability data is interesting for us to collect in that when we look at some of the different variants of part type, you know, consumer versus automotive versus industrial, we're not seeing the reliability curves much different. So we're really looking at, when we're doing the analysis of final analysis, failure analysis of product coming back, What kind of parts are failing consistently? And are we seeing anything that we should be saying, we don't want to be using this type of part anymore? And we do that occasionally, but often we're finding that in many cases it's our application, it's where we're putting something, and we do a lot of work up front in that area to say this part is a perfectly good part, won't live in our environment.
Remind us who you are. Thank you. All right, who's next? The green mic goes to...
Hey, Matt Vogt, BAE Systems. What was your strategy for getting resources when you were doing your data cleanup? We always tend to run into a lot of pushback when we try to get things like component engineering resources to do non-critical tasks. So how did you convince someone that it was critical, or what was your strategy for getting those resources?
Yeah, I convinced, what I did is I worked through my director, the supply management director I work for, but I spent a lot of time talking to the design engineering managers, and we have a very close relationship, and saying, you know that the data set is junk. I'm willing to clean it up, but I'm going to need some bodies to help with it. And right away, they're like, yeah, that makes sense. And one of the funnest things that I ever saw in that area was when I got my team to roll up their sleeves and just get it done, and it took months, I made them go in front of our general manager at our division and present to them. And it just so happened that we were changing ERP systems a year and a half later, and he made the comment to them, you know, guys, I recognize that there's nothing glamorous about this. There's nothing fun about this. This is roll up your sleeves and get it done, but this is critical to our business. Thank you. Well done. When they walked out of that room, I'm certain that their feet weren't touching the ground. They were on cloud nine. So it's really selling that to your colleagues and making them understand, and then really making sure that you're being the commercial for your team. I didn't need the publicity. They needed the publicity of all the important work they were doing. And then you start getting pulls. People want you to be helping. And that's how we've grown our component engineering group, is literally people say, we want you to do this. Sure. We want you to do this. Sure. We want you to do this. Yeah, I can't squeeze any more bloods out of these turnips. And they're like, yeah, you're right. We'll help you get some more people. And that's how we've gone about it.
Well done. I think we have one over here.
Okay, it's coming on. The question is, can you elaborate a little bit how you select high risk, and did it change over time? Did your process change over time?
The way we... I laugh because, honestly, the way we picked it was, we want about 10% high, 15% medium, 75% low. We back of the napkin type of thing, and we said, well, we know our designs are around for years, so we'll pick 8 to 10 years. After running it for several years, that's why we came back and looked at it and went, well, it's that high risk thing is really good. But what's also, and I didn't have time to get into it, is when we see that erosion, and you may have noticed that our low percentage of low risk is going down, our medium risk is growing. High is staying about the same. They're going away. That's kind of something makes sense. So what's happening in that medium then, and that erosion of the low risk, made my design engineering colleagues, when I pointed that out, they went, we probably are getting a little long in the tooth in our reuse. So how do we refresh our designs to use newer parts? And that's really been a big, big part of it. So it's a constant tweaking and evaluating. We haven't changed the numbers, but we've certainly learned a lot about how to use the numbers more effectively.
Outstanding. And that's about all the time we have. Give it up for Paul. Thanks, Dave. Thank you.